Late Yom Lo Laila. Late Laila Lo Yom. Lo Ibain Lit Parse. There is no day without its night. There is no night without its day. Indeed, these two elements cannot be separated. So it is written in that mystical treasury of our literature we call the Zohar. And so it was in Jewish life during 1965. 1965 was a year of frustration and of achievement, It was the year of changing weather, of gray skies alternating with the sunshine and with the storm. In short, it was a year of struggle and of challenge and of prayer, not unlike so many other years in our long ascent through history. Let us begin with the sunshine. For the American Jew, 1965 was another year of unparalleled opportunity. There were few poor among us. The vast majority of the American Jews belonged to the middle class and were aspiring even higher. We were fortunate to possess those professional and academic skills which are in short supply. Strange, is it not? Our centuries of devotion to learning suddenly pays such an extraordinary dividend. And there was, of course, discrimination against us. There was still hung out in some executive suites the unwritten but very real prohibition, no Jew need apply. This was especially true in some of the major banks and the larger utilities, the offices of the large iron and steel and automobile corporations. But the average Jew found these restrictions more irritating than shackling. For him, the basic truth was this, that another Jew had been appointed an associate justice at the Supreme Court, that a Jew had been appointed the ambassador to the United Nations, one of the closest advisors of the president, and more Jews had been elected as representatives and senators to the last Congress than to any other in our history. The sky seemed the limit. There was no door on which we could not knock. There was no office to which we could not aspire. The label Jew had ceased to seem a liability in one's economic and political life. Our children are perhaps the first generation of Jews who will grow up to feel that they cannot empathize with or understand the bitter but loving plaint of our fathers, Schwerz, the Zeinen Ayid. We were grateful for this feeling of welcome. And the American Jew returned to his nation a full measure of gratitude. A recent survey by Fortune magazine revealed that individual Jews contributed some $625 million each year to welfare, relief, and educational causes. This represents some 15% of the total monies given in these types of contributions. And this given by a group which represents only 3 or 3.5% of the American population. Nor was it simply a case of taking care of our own. Roughly 50% of these monies were given to the United Appeals, to secular universities, to medical research, to all that promotes the general welfare. Was our feeling of belonging unwarranted? Were we living emotionally in a fool's paradise? Anti-Semitism was not dead. It raised its ugly head during the New York mayoralty campaign. It could be heard in the crowded white ethnic centers of our megalopolis cities, as these groups flayed against the forces of change crowding in about them. It could be heard in the Negro ghettos of our center cities, as the Jewish shopkeeper and the Jewish apartment owner became a visible symbol of white oppression, a visible target for pent-up emotion. A good deal of Arab propaganda money was lavished at the campus level and around the country in churches and elsewhere to promote anti-Jewish and anti-Semitic activity. And of course, anti-Semitism remained a staple of the diatribe and the literature, the pathological diatribe and literature of the extreme right. The bars at union clubs throughout our land remained high. And each of us heard the unexpected words spoken unexpectedly from unexpected lips. No one could be sure that if this nation suffered an economic tailspin, if the cap on the wells of hatred and passion were suddenly removed, there might not be a sudden outpouring of anger and bitterness and prejudice. But the Jew, by and large, preferred to live with a philosophy that sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. We prefer to accentuate the positive, the accomplishment. To us, to many at least, the high point of the year was the seeming concern by many within the Catholic Church for the removal of that dogmatic teaching which had for so long held the Jew to be a theological pariah, theologically ostracized, and which had taught indirectly that the Jew was the Christ killer, the murderer of God. Was our feeling of belonging unwarranted? Were we living emotionally in a fool's paradise? It all depended, really, on your emotional set, on your historical perspective. For as our tradition remarks, there are some who say, 2 days, bracket each night. And there are others who respond, 2 nights, bracket each day. We lived then in abundant times, times of unparalleled opportunity, but there were storm clouds heavy in the sky. The American Jewish community was floundering in search of itself, in search of its integrity, in search of a purpose. We were asking the basic question, why must there be Jewish survival? Why ought this proud history of ours be continued? Many shrugged their heads sadly as they read the newly published statistics of religious intermarriage. Estimates varied, but apparently from 12 to 20% of marriages involving Jews were marriages with those of other faith or of no faith. But surely we gained as many converts by such marriage as we lost by defection. The problem cut more deeply. The third generation of our American Jewish young people are asking a simple but basic question. What concrete positive difference would it make in my life if I remain a Jew? Prove to me that it is to my benefit, that it is important in my life, that I remain Jewish. And unfortunately, the spiritually naked lives of his parents did not provide him the answer. You cannot build a sober, high philosophy of life on the basis of 2 attendances in the sanctuary in the fall and the signing of a UJA card in the spring. Nor had the American Jewish community made it clear to this younger generation what was unique, what was necessary about a Jewish hospital, or a Jewish old folks home, or even a Jewish community center. Our young people want a sense of the depth, of the profundity, of the vitality, of the urgency of the Jewish tradition. We preferred the simplicities and the naivete, a life lacking in religious discipline, a life lacking entirely in religious depth. Now, there is no day without its night. It was not all during 1965 a an image in our community of which was fraying at the edges, unraveling loyalties. More of our adolescents were receiving a Jewish education at a high school level than ever before. There was some evidence of renewed interest in Judaism on the campus. Every congregation could point to a loyal few who were disciplined, who turned again and again to the Torah, to the tradition, to the learning, who were happy in the ritual and in the rite, who were present at the worship. But the question remained, was this small minority sufficient to be what the prophet called a Sha'ar Yashuv, a saving remnant? Could we build the edifice of Jewish life for the next generation on this small foundation? Was it enough? At year's end, the answer was not yet clear. 1965 was the year in which the Vatican Council closed. It was therefore the year in which the Catholic Church finally put on paper, passed and promulgated a schema on the Jews. This document had, as you know, rough sailing of it. It was revised and revised again, quibbled over, haggled over, defined and redefined. But finally, it was set down and sent forth. What shall we say in sum? The Catholic Church extended to the Jew a hand of friendship, and that the Catholic Church extended to the Jew its program of missions. There are some among us whose temperature rises and falls with every word or silence among those of other faiths about the goodness and the validity of our faith. Some of these took the passage of these few words as proof that we were coming into the Messianic age, and they are misguided. All that we have is a few words set down in Rome by a few men, black ink on white paper. And there were, on the other hand, those who saw only the haggling, only the difficulty which this document had in the passage, who saw only the fact that this was black ink on white paper. These took a jaundiced view of this document. Perhaps the most sobering view that we can take is this: that the Catholic Church offered civic responsibility, and the Catholic Church reminded the Jew of his corporate responsibility. There are many within the church who are eager to join with us in the cause of humanity, to establish racial and economic justice, to establish peace. There are a few within the church, who are concerned with the impact of Christian teaching on prejudice. But the church has not dissolved its missions. Indeed, it has refined them. The church has not recognized the state of Israel. Indeed, much of the quibbling over this document occurred because of Arab protest. The church has no responsibility for the survival of the Jewish people. That is our responsibility. The church looks forward to the day when the Jewish people shall be amalgamated into the corporation of Christ, not to the day when Judaism will be one of the many expressions of the faith of God enjoyed by the sons of men. The simple, hard fact of life remained that our survival rests upon our shoulders where it has always rested. That if we fail to show the sturdiness and the faith, the courage and the discipline which will make possible that survival, we will not survive. All of the volumes of goodwill which have been written, all of the speeches of brotherhood which have been spoken, will not establish our future, will not secure Israel, will not give life and vitality and vigor to the congregations of Israel. That is our responsibility, as it has always been and as it should be. And that is our challenge in the years and decades ahead. 1965 was a year of protest and of rally and of meeting in the American Jewish community. The concern, Soviet anti-Semitism. the concern, the continuing harassment by the Russian government of those whose passports have stamped upon it the word Ivraishka, Jew. As you know, I have not been unqualifiedly a supporter of these protest meetings. I fail to see the clear analogy between Russia in 1965 and Germany in 1935. The life of the individual Russian Jew has not been threatened. And the Russian bear is of a notoriously evil temper. And I fear that if he be goaded too far, he will swipe with his paw and take away the livelihood and the opportunity of the 3 million people behind the Iron Curtain, the 3 million Jews who cannot put their placards down and leave the meeting and return to their secure homes. Nor was there much evidence that 2.5 years of organized protest by the American Jewish community had led to serious results. Yes, there seemed to be a recess in the docketing for trial of cases in Russia involving economic crimes, presumably committed by Jews, but perhaps all these trials were simply completed. And yes, the Soviet government did allow, before Passover this year, some few dozen leaves of matzah to be baked in Moscow and in Leningrad. But at the end of the year, the status of the Russian Jew was status quo ante, much as it had been before. Over 500 synagogues remained shut. The Russian government had made some promises to the Jewish community in Moscow to allow them to publish Sidurim, prayer books, and luachs, calendars. None of these had been acted upon. The yeshiva, which had been, by various subterfuges, closed, remained closed. Nor, in my humble estimation, will we achieve what is really the only viable solution to the Jewish problem in the Soviet Union by this kind of pressure. Judaism cannot survive in a confessedly atheist state, in a state with a history of anti-Semitic prejudice shown by the Cossack, by the white Russian. Anti-Semitism in Russia today is a malicious combination of deliberate political propaganda, engineered for the benefit of the Arab world, engineered for the benefit of Russian interests in the Arab world, and of the age-old fear of the Jew deep in the soul of the Russian people. For there to be survival as Jews and freedom for this community, there must be emigration. I'm afraid that the ultimate solution to the Jewish problem in the Soviet Union requires that the Jews who remain Jews leave the Soviet Union. And no great government will allow its people exodus, freedom, under pressure. No great government can lose face to that degree. You cannot go to government and tell them that they are not doing what must be done for their people and expect them to allow the people to go into freedom. Quieter diplomacy is required. For Judaism, even if it be allowed and licit within this atheist state, cannot long survive within the Soviet Union. For the Judaism which exists there is medieval, archaic, the faith of a past century, a faith which cannot teach and reach and challenge the child of the 20th century. It's deliberately kept so. We have made no efforts to modernize it, to send in rabbis and lay leaders who might teach this Jewry modern ways, the modern idiom. We would have a terrible scandal with our more orthodox brethren if we did. Soviet Jewry cannot bear that scandal at the moment. So the solution lies in emigration, in Israel, in the opening of doors in the West. And I'm afraid that these movements of protest, these rallies, however understandable they be, do not offer the subtleness, the diplomacy, the power which will make this emigration ultimately possible. To the west of the 3 million Jews who suffered harassment within the Soviet Union were the 35,000 Jews who returned to Germany. For these Jews, 1965 was a gray year spent in a nation of unparalleled prosperity. These Jews were constantly reminded that denazification is an image beloved in the West, which does not necessarily conform to reality within the German Republic. During 1965, cemeteries were desecrated. Synagogues were daubed with a swastika. The magazine of the Legionnaires and of the other neo-Nazi parties in Germany spewed out any number of violently and viciously anti-Semitic articles. Anti-Semitism was an unspoken but very real passion in the last West German election. Indeed, it was to silence the neo-Nazi groups that the West German government sought to be so adamant to bring the war crimes trials to an end in May of 1965. Germany, however, could not be quit of its Jewish problem. It faced Germany month after month during the year. In January, you'll recall, there was signed in Cairo that agreement between General Nasser and the representative of Chancellor Erhard, in which the Egyptians promised not to give official recognition to Pankow, to the East German government of Herr Ulbricht. And Germany, in return, promised to cancel unilaterally an arms purchase agreement between Bonn and Jerusalem. And there was a secret protocol added to this convention. The West German government pledged that it would not recognize, that it would never recognize the State of Israel. Bonn spent the early months of this year bemused at the violence of the reaction in the capitals of Western Europe, the violence of the reaction by the Jewish community. After all, Bonn kept saying, we have paid the Jews reparations, blood money. What more does a Jew want? One could hear in their pronouncements the echo of the far more malicious and deliberate statements of another German. General Nasser overstepped his case. He finally angered the Germans so much by the welcome which he promised to Mr. Ulbricht at the end of this, shall we call it, political mess, was the agreement by Bonn to recognize Israel, the exchange of ambassadors with Israel, and the reestablishment of the broken arms purchase agreement. But the true direction of German policy was shown. The fires burned close to the surface. The end of the year, in November, it's 2 months ago, the West German government suddenly announced that it would cease the payment, the repayment of war reparations still owed to 150,000 who survived the Holocaust. The ostensible reason, the published reason, was budgetary restriction. The unpublished reason, the real reason, was the need to throw a bone to the resurgent neo-Nazi fascist groups within Germany to keep them in line. Germany has not yet fought out its battle with its Christian German conscience. The Jew of Germany lives on quicksand. Skies are threatening. His life insecure. One of those who fled, one of those who survived the war and sought to reestablish a new life in Israel, one of the million Jews who joined the European Jews, Jews from North Africa, from the Near East, from India and elsewhere. What of Israel during 1965? The sun shone in Israel in 1965. There was a golden citrus crop. There was the richest harvest ever. The standard of living rose to unprecedented heights. Israel seemed so well off economically that the United States government removed Israel from the list of those emerging nations whose modest standard of living qualifies them for certain special privileges in our foreign aid program. 1965 was an election year in Israel. Elections which are held in prosperous times are seldom fought bitterly and over issues. And so by and large, this was true of the election to the Sixth Knesset. It proved only two things. One, that Israel, like the United States, requires a limitation on electioneering and campaigning. The electioneering and the campaigning lasted some 6 months till everyone was mightily tired of it. And secondly, that however much many Israelis might revere their founding Prime Minister, Mr. David Ben-Gurion, they had no desire to return him to power. The feature, the one ugly feature of the election campaign of this fall was the vindictive, vocal, and vitriolic campaign by Mr. Ben-Gurion against the man who had been his hand-picked successor in office, Levi Eshkol. Ben-Gurion had expected, apparently, to retire, but to retain a final say, a veto, over all major issues of policy. He broke with Mr. Eshkol, he broke with the party he had led for so many years. He fought Eshkol, he created a new party for this election. And before the election, he confidently predicted that the Rafi, his new party, would secure 62 seats in the 6th Knesset, an absolute majority. Some of his partisans, a little more realistic, spoke of 25, 30, or 35 seats. In fact, the Rafi won only 10. And this showing was acknowledged by all parties within Israel, by all observers, to be a deliberate and bitter personal defeat for Mr. Ben-Gurion. Levi Eshkol had received his mandate for continuing leadership, but at year's end he was having difficulty exercising that mandate. 7 weeks ago he was re-elected. His party received the largest number of seats in the Knesset. Today he has yet to form his coalition, his cabinet, which will allow him to rule Israel. Why? Because Israel must face and is facing a religious crisis. The Orthodox religious groups, as political parties, have been members of a Mapai coalition since the creation of the State of Israel. And they have created a form of government. They have won certain concessions in which the state insists upon this Orthodox form of religious life or religious authority. Israel, however, is modern in its temper and its time. Many in Israel are restive under Sabbath blue laws. A league against religious coercion has been established in Israel. Feeling the opposition, the religious parties have doubled and tripled their demands. They insist that Eshkol agree to use the coercive powers of the government to enforce Sabbath regulation. So far, Mr. Eshkol has refused to do so. He has sought other means to establish his coalition. If the coalition is established without the religious parties, we may see the slow beginnings of a separation of church and state, an end much to be desired. If he finds that he cannot establish the coalition without the religious parties, and he makes concessions to them, Israel will only have put off a major struggle with its own conscience, with its own self, which cannot be put off indefinitely. These were economically prosperous years for the average Israeli. But there is again no sky without its clouds. There is no day without its storm signals. German reparations money ceased to come into Israel during 1965 in large sums, threatening the balance of payment, threatening the gold reserves of the nation. Israel ceased to be competitive in some economic markets because of its labor policies. And most of all, and most dangerous of all, the specter of inflation hung over the land. Wages rose by some 20%. Prices rose from 20 to 100%, and in luxury sometimes more. Israel faces in the near future a tightening of the belt, policies which will restrict the consumer economy so that Israel can compete in the international market. Israel can increase its gross national product. Israel can survive as a strong and vital economic entity. These decisions will have to be taken if Israel is to remain vigorous and economically sound. No one in power in Israel has yet made clear the economic policies to be adopted, but that Israel can continue to spend millions for deterrent arms, to spend millions to bring in and to assimilate the refugee, those who require the homeland, to spend millions on raising the standard of living, on building, producing, merchandising, and marketing consumer products. It's clear, cannot be done. 1965 began for Israel under the threat of war. In September of 1964, a Cairo conference of all the Arab states proclaimed war if Israel were to turn on the Jordan Valley water carrier, which was designed, as you know, to draw the waters from the Galilee into the Negev. The Jordan Valley water carrier was put into operation, and there was no war. 70,000 of General Nasser's troops were tied down in the rocky hills of the Yemen. It was not a propitious moment. And so a hastily summoned Pan-Arab Summit Conference in Cairo in January of 1965 announced not war, but the building of a series of coffer dams on the Hashbani and the Gor and the other tributaries which feed the Jordan, which would divert the waters of the Jordan before these reached Israel and in effect nullify the water scheme. Oil royalties from Kuwait and Bahrain and Iraq were set aside to finance these projects. Lebanon, Syria, Jordan began such products. Accurate Israeli shelling brought them to a quick halt. The threat of war seemed to pass from the Middle East. Indeed, so hopeful were some in our State Department. By year's end, they had refurbished General Nasser. We found him again worthy of our aid. They were arguing again that American aid to General Nasser was a means of pacifying the Middle East. Amazing man, this. He can attack every element of American international policy. He can proclaim war in the Yemen, which we sought to avoid. He can bring pressure on Libya to force us out of our giant Air Force base at Wheeler. He can send arms and money to the rebels in the Congo we are trying to suppress. His country can be the way station for Chinese communist agents for all of Africa. He can peddle his revolution and his murder into Jordan, into Iran, into Iraq, into Saudi Arabia, lands whose government stability we seek to maintain. He can attack on Radio Cairo American policies as militaristic, neo-colonial, racist, and the like. He can burn our information office and tell us to go jump into the sea. And we continue to finance his government and his regime. General Nasser can take the grain raised by his people over on that 10% of Egypt, which is arable. He can take grain which his own people require, they are badly fed, 80% suffer from malnutrition, and sell it to communist China for armament. And we, in our good Samaritan Santa Claus clothes, insist that these people must be fed. And we ship, it will be $55 million worth of cereal grains and other foodstuffs to Egypt during the first 6 months of this year. The threat of war, Washington believed, was raised in the Palestine from the Israel frontiers during 1965. But Washington ought to know by now, really, that in the Middle East, reality is not what things seem to be on the surface. The Bedouin, the Arab, knows a mirage when he sees one. 1965 was a year in which the arms race stepped up in earnest. In January of 1965, General Nasser signed with the Soviet Union his third, one-third of $1 billion arms purchase agreement with Soviet Russia. At that time, General Nasser already had within his arsenal more armor, more planes, more tanks, not to speak of missiles, than the entire firepower of the Allied and Axis armies during the North African and African campaigns of the Second World War. In December of 1965, Marshal Greco, the Deputy Minister of Defense of the Soviet Union, and General Nasser initialed an agreement in Cairo, which provided that the Soviet Union would provide over the next number of years all of the military requirements of General Nasser's army. supersonic planes, ground-to-air missiles, ground-to-ground missiles, submarines, tanks, armor, gas, and the like. Nor was General Nasser the only head of state in the Middle East to receive arms. It has been an aim of American policy during this last year to create a counterpoise, political counterpoise to the power of Nasser. Our reasons are rather selfish. We seek to protect our oil investments from nationalization, from revolutionary expropriation. And so we have depended upon Saudi Arabia, that absolutist royalist state, upon Iran, that feudal monarchist state. And we finally, in November of this year, brought these two major powers together, got them to sign a mutual non-aggression pact, added to these two nations the smaller dependencies of Jordan and the Lebanon, and we're happy to announce that we would sell, we and the British, $400 million worth of supersonic plane and of missiles to this new alliance. Now, the Israeli understands our desire to undercut General Nasser. The Israeli would understand it better if we were serious about it. The Israeli read the headlines of Kashmir, and the Israeli knows that guns which are sent abroad for any purpose can be turned against any enemy. We sent to Pakistan arms against the Soviet Union. We sent to India arms to be used against the Chinese. And suddenly, Pakistani and Indian were using the same American arms against each other. So it is in the Middle East. Arms that we send to Iran, to Saudi Arabia, to be used against General Nasser, can be turned. And you're dead before your protest has been lodged through official channels in Washington. Perhaps the vignette which sums up the increased pace of the arms race in the Middle East was a little scene played out in September at a Red Sea port in Jordan. Two ships had brought in the first of a major shipment of American tanks to the Jordanian army. King Hussein ascended the platform and spoke. These arms, he said, will provide our defense. And they will permit us, he said, to win back that which has been taken from us. Unless anyone misunderstands the prince's meaning, his prime minister, Wasif El-Tel, mounted the platform after him, and he said, and I quote, "The army of Jordan is now sufficiently strong militarily to set the date and the time and the place of the invasion of Israel." And lest anybody mistake him, seated on the dais were the officers, the generals, the Arab Joint Command Against Israel, that group of irregular troops recruited largely from Palestine refugees, supplied with Russian arms by Egypt, officered by Jordanian, Iraqi, Syrian, Lebanese, and Egyptian men, who have been conducting fedayeen attacks, sabotage and murder attacks on Israel, and who are to be the spearhead of what the Arabs label the ultimate solution to the Palestine problem. American tanks, ultimate solution to the Israel problem. Will there be war in the Middle East? Probably not for the next few months. A condition of the Soviet aid to Egypt seems to have been that they pulled back from the peace negotiations at Harad and fight through the Yemenite war to a more successful conclusion. It requires some 3 to 4 years before the American and British jets and missiles are effectively emplaced and manned in Saudi Arabia and in Iran. There is time, a month, 6 months, a year, perhaps two. But let no one mistake the ultimate purpose of the Arab nations. They have proclaimed jihad, the ancient to the death cry of the Bedouin. And only the protective mantle of the great nations of the world will protect Israel, protect the Middle East from war and bloodshed and carnage. Israel is grateful to the United States for the many millions of dollars of aid which has been extended. Israel is grateful to the United States for its political help, the United Nations and elsewhere. Israel would be more grateful to the United States if the United States would finally, once and for all, proclaim its concern with the vitality of the one true democracy in the Middle East, our concern with the survival of this democracy, our willingness to shield its borders from attack by anyone wearing any uniform at any time. Far more than foodstuff aid and military aid, this would contribute to peace in the Middle East. But we have not seen fit to do so. We give to the one side and to the other. And in the military field, we give only to the other side. Israel has had to purchase arms where she can in the world, spend a great deal of her vital budget, her straitened budget, for deterrent weapons. It's a shame, crying shame. Yet what else can she do? Israel requires peace. Israel has time and again affirmed its willingness to negotiate any outstanding issue. Israel has time and again affirmed that it covets no nation's territory. And yet arms pour in to those who would put the sword to Israel's jugular vein. Late Yom Bli Laila. Late Laila Bli Yom. Lo Abeun Li Parse. There is no day without its night. There is no night without its day. And these two elements in human life cannot be separated. Am Yisrael Chai. This glorious people, Israel, is alive. That is the day. This people, Israel, has an opportunity to take its survival in hand and contribute largely to its world, to contribute to the security of its congregations and of its ancient homeland. But if we play the ostrich, if we enjoy only the pleasures, if we live off the good things of the moment and forget the night cometh, we play a fool's game. We speed our own destruction. Watchmen, what of the night? Watchmen, what of the night? And his answer, the morning cometh, but also the night.